Let's go back to 1996. The X-Files were fresh and popular. The nightly AM airwaves were ruled from the desert compound of Art Bell. And in the tropics, a new menace troubled ranchers, a blood-sucking animal known as El Chupacabra. Before it became the go-to explanation for every mysterious animal corpse, the Chupacabra was a serious threat for poor, hardscrabble ranchers who feared this blood-sucking monster and what it could do to their livestock. 15 years have gone by, and the Chupacabra has become a punchline for many people. Hairless dogs are hardly the stuff of nightmare. But Ben Radford remembers the original claims, the strange, hairless humanoid creature which seemed to have amazing powers of leaping, flying, and more. Inspired to get to the bottom of it, Ben worked for 5 years to find out what was behind the story, and now his findings are available in his newest book, Tracking the Chupacabra, today on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno, we look at the science behind monster stories. This week, it's just Ben and me. Karen is out sick, but hopefully we'll be back in the podcasting saddle very soon. Our interview today is with Ben Radford, a regular co-host on our show, and the author of several books on monstrous topics. Today, we're discussing his latest, Tracking the Chupacabra. You can get a copy of his book at radfordbooks.com or check the show notes at monstertalk.org.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk. Today we're going to be talking to author and Monster Talk co-host Benjamin Radford about his new book. What's your new book called, Ben?
It's Tracking the Chupacabra, the vampire beast in fact, fiction, and folklore.
Awesome.
Yeah. I think it's awesome. I spent a lot of time working on it, so you have.
I since you shared some of your research with myself and Karen and Daniel Oxton as you were working on it, it was kind of fun to see it all come together. And now you've got your book, so I'm proud of you. Good job.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's as you know, in skepticism, a lot of times the thank yous are not forthcoming. You usually just get the barbs from the believers who are pissed off at you. So it's nice to get a couple pats on the back, especially for skeptical work. So thanks.
Well, you know, as a writer, it's also good to see somebody finish something they started. So that's always nice.
Right. Exactly. It's easy enough to start. I mean, I've started, you know, dozens of articles and books, and finishing it, that's the rub, as they say.
It is. So how did you pick the Chupacabra as a topic?
That's a great question. I think that I was intrigued by it for a number of reasons. The first one was that it seemed to be a relatively recent monster. Of course, you know, as you know, with the case of the Loch Ness monster, the sightings themselves only date back to about the 1930s, but the supposed mythologies behind it date back much earlier, depending on who you talk to. The same with Bigfoot. You know, that's really only been around since about the 50s, but they sort of roped in wild man stories and, you know, Native American mythologies and stuff. But in the case of the Chupacabra, that didn't really exist. It would just sort of suddenly just popped essentially out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. And so I was intrigued by that because, of course, real animals don't just appear out of nowhere. you don't just say, you know, an unknown dragon-like creature suddenly appeared over, you know, Boston's, you know, stadium or something. So that was one of the things that really intrigued me. And then also, of course, the fact that it was a vampire was interesting to me. And so there were, and also the fact that I speak Spanish and I've traveled extensively throughout Latin America. So it was kind of a confluence of many different factors that led me into the mysterious realm of the Chupacabra.
In your words, vampires, anything that drinks blood, is that right?
Yeah, I'll go with that. Basically, anything that's either repeated to drink blood or does, in fact, drink blood.
What does it look like? What does the Chupacabra look like, the original version? We'll talk about the fact that there's more than one form of it, but...
Well, the original version of the Chupacabra, and I can get into the original witness a little bit later on, but the original one was a bipedal sort of man-like creature between 3 and 5 feet tall, had large red or black alien-like eyes, sort of like the alien wraparound eyes you often see depicted on the grays, for example. Had a very distinct... what's that?
The gray aliens for...
The gray aliens, yes. Yeah. Sorry. It had a very distinctive row of spikes down the back that were described as either sort of feathers or spikes or feathery spikes. Had long claws, long fingers. Some people said it had wings. But basically, that's the original one. And then there were sort of spin-offs of that. So when you look at that, that's sort of the original eyewitness account. And then within within a few months, actually, other people started reporting sort of variations on that theme. And I can talk a little bit about that if you want.
One version of it is humanoid.
Yes, yes.
And what's the other version?
Well, the other version is canid, sort of what the dog-like animals. Canids include everything from dogs, foxes, coyotes, and things like that. And these are, they basically just look like essentially hairless, probably mangy, dogs or coyotes. They're four-legged. They have prominent canine teeth. That's the other version. And it's interesting. You can actually create a timeline on this, because the original Chupacabra was mostly seen, the one I previously described, was mostly seen around between about 1995 and, say, 2000, almost exclusively in Latin America, and a couple other places. And then the type 2 Chupacabra, what I've called the Texas Chupacabra, appeared in about 2004 to the present. So there was this interesting sort of timeline where the Chupacabra definitely morphed forms and essentially changed what it was and what people were interpreting.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. It sort of just popped out of nowhere in 1995. Did it come with an origin story, or did it just come with the sighting and the origin stories came later, or how did that work out?
That's actually one of the most fascinating parts about it. When I was researching the book, I went to Puerto Rico and I interviewed several people there and did, of course, a lot of research on it. And what's interesting, you have to look at the social and cultural context in which these sightings emerged. What happened was that in early 1995, there had been reports of things that the animals that were said to have been mysteriously drained of blood in different parts around the island of Puerto Rico. And it hadn't really sort of turned into like a fever pitch fear or hysteria, but there were rumors and gossip of, some sort of unknown vampiric creature that, it would have attacked some goats in one part of the island or some chickens here or there. And the tabloids, in fact, there were two main tabloids in Puerto Rico, El Vocero and El Nuevo Día, and both of those were sort of like the equivalent of the National Enquirer, and they loved these stories. As you can imagine, every time that, some farmer in some remote place said that he had, dead chickens or goats, they dispatched a reporter and they got, very gory, gruesome, dramatic photos of, of these dead animals laying there and the farmer talking about how mysterious it was. So a lot of this was actually fueled by tabloids and sensational press at the time. But nobody had really seen the creature. There had been essentially up until August or so of 95, it was all just sort of rumors and gossip and sort of some sort of vague thing that may or may not have been attacking things. But it wasn't until August that there was actually a face and a whole description of the creature. And that's sort of where the original one came from.
Who gave it that face?
That was a woman named Madeline Tolentino. Hers was the original description of the Chupacabra that became world famous. In fact, if you do a Google image search for Chupacabra, you'll find a lot of it different images, but there's one primary image that sort of has, again, this alien-like creature, has spikes down the back, big, has large eyes, sort of fangs, almost no nose, and bipedal, things like that. And that was her original description. And interestingly enough, the original Chupacabra reports, including Miss Tolentino's, was originally investigated, and I'm using scare quotes, I'm using air quotes around investigated, by UFO buffs in Puerto Rico at the time. And almost all of the original reports, investigations, such as they were by UFO believers and tabloid reporters. So there was little or no real scientific skeptical investigation done, certainly in the 1990s, and I would argue up until essentially the time I wrote the book. But that's one of the interesting elements to it.
Yeah, so I know there's sort of a folklore aspect to the Chupacabra. Mm-hmm. I've read accounts that it was an alien. It was an alien's pet. Mm-hmm. It was a hybrid creature created at a secret genetics lab underneath the observatory down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Arecibo, yeah.
Yeah, and so
yeah. Again, this is another fascinating aspect to it. Is why are all these origin stories? I'll give you the top, say, three or four. One of the most popular ones is exactly as you said, that it was an alien's pet. That there's a connection to extraterrestrials, and UFOs and aliens had been visiting the island of Puerto Rico and elsewhere, of course. And they, I guess, sort of opened the door, and this their pet ran out into the wilderness, and they called for it, Chupacabra, Chupacabra, and never came back. And so since that time, it's been living in the El Yunque forest. So that's one story, is that it's an extraterrestrial origin. The other main explanation for it is that it's the result of top secret U.S. government's genetics experiments, especially particularly in the El Yunque rainforest, which is not too far from the capital of San Juan. And so for many people, El Yunque, this sort of jungle-like, again, rainforest area, it was thought to be either the origin or the home of the Chupacabra for many people. Other people believe that the Chupacabra was the source of the AIDS epidemic. That AIDS was created by the Chupacabra or by extraterrestrials through the Chupacabra that were going to try and depopulate the Earth.
I also had a time machine. But
yeah, remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, there's chronology.
The chronology. Other people, for example, believe that the Chupacabra was a portent of Armageddon. I did some research for the book, and I came across a couple fundamentalist Christians who have written that the Chupacabra is referred to in the battle of in descriptions of Armageddon, for example. So you've got this sort of interesting end times theology. There's a guy named James Lloyd, who's the founder of the Christian Media Network Ministry, and he talks about how Revelations 9, he claims, describes the Chupacabra. And he says that the Chupacabra is, in fact, a militarized weapon created by the U.S. government that's, you know, going to be unleashed on evildoers or something.
To me, having done several interviews on the topic of genetics and genetic manipulation here on Monster Talk, how different real genetic research is from the sort of fantasy version that the conspiracy-minded public comes up with. You know, in the fantasy world, anybody can just build anything in remote labs.
And
it's like they have. It's not just a funding issue. It's the fact that they bring these things to life and then let them go. You know,
what else are they to do, right?
I don't know. It's just a little odd. Well, you know, so there's these stories about the Chupacabra, the humanoid version. Does the mm-hmm. when the Type 2 canid chupacabra comes onto the scene, does it get an origin story? Or I don't, or what is there any folkloric explanation for why they're calling these chupacabras?
That's another good question. I think that you don't really find as much of the origin stories behind that version of chupacabra, partly because in the other distinction you have to understand between the sort of type 1 and type 2 chupacabras is nobody has ever found a type 1 chupacabra. Basically, again, the humanoid or reptilian or kangaroo with wings, or I mean, there's a wide variety of descriptions to it. These have only been sighted and reported. They've never been photographed or anything else like that. The type two chupacabras, what I would call the Texas chupacabras. In these cases, we have a dead body. We actually have a physical specimen. And again, this also distinguishes it from, for example, a Bigfoot, Loch Ness monster, Mothman, dragons, unicorns, mermaids, except of course the Fiji mermaid, and other things like that, in which these are, we have no hard physical forensic evidence. In the case of the chupacabra, allegedly we do. We've got half a dozen or so dead chupacabras that can be examined and tested. So I think that partly because there is the hard physical body. That sort of detracts, I think, from the folklore behind it.
Well, do you want to talk about some of these cases where they found these bodies?
Sure, sure. I mean, there's been about, about a half dozen or so. The original, not the best known, but the original, I think, as far as I know, the first chupacabra report in terms of, the type 2 chupacabra, the canid type, came from August 2000 in the village of Mapasillo, Nicaragua. There was a farmer named Jorge Talavera, who it's kind of a long story. I won't get into the details here. You can read it in the book. But basically, he claimed that some animal was attacking his livestock and goats, and he finally got tired of it, and he said, "I'm gonna catch this damn thing." And so he and a ranch hand camped out overnight, and they sort of waited in the cold darkness, and finally they saw one or two. The description varies; not sure if there's one or two, but one or two sort of four-legged monsters, basically, that he interpreted as the chupacabra that were attacking his animals. He shot at them. He hit one of them, and then it sort of ran off into the darkness. A couple of days later, his ranch hand was walking around a remote part of his ranch, and he came across some vultures feeding on a carcass, and it was basically reduced to a skeleton. I mean, there was a little bit of meat behind it, but it was essentially a skeleton. And he said, "Well, this must be the chupacabra." And the story then made national news, international news, in fact. And reporters were calling from, Japan, Italy, New York, wanting to find out, had we found the chupacabra? Because again, this was the very first time somebody had claimed to find an actual body of the chupacabra. Again, it's kind of a long, involved story, but basically, he asked the local university to examine the remains, they came back dog. That it was not, in fact, an unknown creature. It wasn't a vampire. It was an ordinary dog. And he later disputed this account and claimed that there was a conspiracy behind it, that they had actually switched the bones. But that was the first found body. Probably the best known is the Cuero chupacabra in Cuero, Texas, found by a woman named Phyllis Canyon. And I investigated that in part along with the TV show Monster Quest in 2008, and that was where this woman found a dead type 2 chupacabra, four legs, hairless or nearly hairless, near her ranch, and she went into it and examined it, and she ended up having some DNA tests run on it by Todd DeSattel, among others, I believe. That came back coyote. As with Mr. Talavera, Phyllis Canyon was not happy with this. This DNA results and disputed them. She asked for a second set of tests, which were done, and it came back essentially the same, but with the added caveat that there may be some wolf in it, some red wolf. Again, in all these different cases, you have, you know, somebody finds a dead weird thing, basically. And if there's a body there, then someone says, "Oh, I wonder what this weird thing is." And then oftentimes they'll go to the internet and they'll do a Google search for weird, you know, weird monster in Texas, and the chupacabra will pop up, and they'll say, "Well, there it is, and that's it must be the chupacabra." Or other times, oftentimes, particularly in Texas, ranch hands, Spanish speaking ranch hands, often will call the chupacabra, because again, so the chupacabra originally, of course, the original chupacabra means goat sucker in Spanish, because it's supposed to suck the blood out of goats and also livestock and cats and chickens and other things. But over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, the word chupacabra has basically come to mean anything weird, any unusual creature or anything else that somebody has found that may or may not have any actual relevance to blood sucking or vampirism or anything else like that. So again, there's other ones. There's the Blanco Texas Chupacabra, Elmendorf. There were a couple found here in New Mexico and elsewhere. But those are a couple of the highlights.
Unlike Bigfoot or Nessie, or actually most of the monsters we talk about, this is a vampire creature in its original form. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? Where does the blood sucking come from?
Well, the blood suck,
because it sounds like it actually predated the actual sightings.
Yeah, that's, again, another fascinating aspect to it. What you have to remember is that with the original reports, when you're looking at the original reports from, for example, early 1995, Puerto Rico, the people weren't calling it the chupacabra at that time. It was just something is attacking livestock and it appears to be drained of blood and we think it's weird and whatever else. And it wasn't really until around August or so, that again, in August was when the first person actually saw the creature. At that point, everyone's like, "Oh my God, this is what people have been seeing and reporting. And, you know, this is what's attacking the animals." Tolentino herself didn't, as far as I know, didn't actually call it the chupacabra. She didn't come up with that name. I think she just said, "I saw something weird," and other people, you know, put the chupacabra label onto that. So again, there was definitely a vampiric aspect to it. That was essentially its signature form of predation. I mean, that's what that is, and that's what the chupacabra does. It sucks goat's blood. In my book, I put it within the context of other vampires around the world, and so for example, I looked at the European vampire and the stories of the story. I looked at the European vampire and the stories of the creatures that were said to drain blood or other bodily substances from the living. They were oftentimes blamed for bad things happening. And I also looked into, for example, African vampires and some of the stories of vampiric entities and creatures and sometimes people. Oftentimes, white people. There's a strong element of xenophobia and fear of foreigners in vampire stories in general, and specifically in the chupacabra as well. And I also go into other Latin American vampires, such as the Liquichiri creature, which I investigated in Bolivia, in Peru, which sucks the fat out of people. So there's a whole. So the chupacabra really fits very well within the context of other vampire claims. And so that's why I spend chapter two in the book talking about that.
Well, you'd think a vampire that sucked fat would come to America, not Peru.
You would think. I've written about that extent. That's a whole different subject. But it definitely feeds into the whole chupacabra story.
What's your book like? What kind of style is it? And describe it a little bit for our listeners.
It was a little bit tricky trying to figure out how I was going to cast it. I spent about 5 years researching it and about a year or two writing it. When I finally felt that I had investigated the chupacabra to the best of my ability, you know, I had looked at all the carcasses, as many as I could. You know, many of them I physically went and personally examined. I went looking for the chupacabra in Nicaragua, in the jungles of Nicaragua, for about a week a couple years ago, and sort of doing an actual field expedition out, you know, physically looking for it, not just sort of sitting back in my armchair. But so it was a little tricky trying to decide how I was going to present all the different stuff. And so what I tried to do was I basically tried to bring some science to the whole thing, but also keep some of the interest and the mystery to it. So I talk about in the first part, I talk about the history of the chupacabra and, you know, what is it? Where did it come from? What are the stories behind it? And then I go into the folklore behind it, because a lot of times when you, no matter what monster you're talking about, whether it's Bigfoot or Nessie or Mothman or Spring-Heeled Jack or what have you, there's a rich tradition of folklore and stories behind it. That's not to say that these creatures are necessarily mythical, because there may be folklore around, you know, real existing animals as well. But to really understand the chupacabra, because so much of it did seem to sort of trace back to folklore, I talked a little bit about the chupacabra in popular culture, in how people perceive it. Again, getting into the different theories behind it, you know, is it the source of the AIDS epidemic? Is it a portent of the end times? Is it an extraterrestrial? What is it? And then in the middle part of the book, I talk about searching for the chupacabra, and, you know, actually going out and looking for it. And again, getting into the time spent in the jungles of Nicaragua, looking into the dead chupacabras and the carcasses, and exploring some of the stories behind those. And then in the last part, I sort of bring it all together, and I bring the reader back to the original questions of, you know, what is the chupacabra? Could it actually exist? Could it suck blood? Could the animals that have been found, you know, the so-called type 2 Texas chupacabras, could they have sucked blood? Could they be the chupacabra? And I sort of get into the more the forensics and the biology and the folklore of it. So I sort of structured it as sort of a mystery to be solved. Sort of, you know, hey, here's this interesting mystery. Let me bring you along as we sort of look at all the different aspects of the chupacabra and figure out, you know, could this be real? So that's sort of how I tried to structure the book.
Well, if someone buys the book, do you actually have the solution? Is there an answer to the mystery of the chupacabra?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. And as a writer and investigator, I am very cautious about making statements that I can't back up, just because I'm used to being sort of questioned and attacked and prodded, you know, about some of the claims. And so I do not take it lightly to say that I believe I've solved the mystery of the chupacabra. I absolutely believe I have. I think that somebody who reads the whole book, who's open-minded about it. I mean, if you absolutely will not be convinced that the chupacabra does not exist, then, you know, nothing I say or write is going to change your mind. There's no evidence that I can present that will change your mind on that. But I was very careful to sort of piece together all the elements and all the evidence and arguments. If there's any, let me put it this way. If there are any remaining questions about the chupacabra, I'd be happy to field the questions from readers or listeners. Again, I'm not being facetious. If there's anything you don't understand, let me know what it is, because I can explain it to you. And that's actually one of the things I find most interesting about it, is that, you know, it's one of the very few high profile solved mysteries, in my opinion, and, you know, of course, readers can judge for themselves, but that have really come out in the last, you know, few decades, really. You know, there's lots and lots of, I mean, I could never claim that I had, you know, solved the mystery of Bigfoot or solved the mystery of, you know, lake monsters, because there's too much out there. There's too much information. There, you know, are too many reports. There's too many aspects to it. But in the case of the chupacabra, because it's only been around for about 15 years, there are finite reports. There's only so many carcasses. There's only so many witnesses interviewed. There's only so many aspects to it. And it can be a very complex and nuanced investigation, but ultimately, it's sort of packaged all in one, piece. I mean, there's finite information on it, and because of that, that's to my mind what made it solvable.
Your book will end the parade of pathetic, hairless animals that are being called chupacabra by the media.
I'm sure it won't. I mean, that was, this is always the problem that you know skeptical investigators have, is that you can put forth explanations for things, and you can do your best to try to explain and solve them, but ultimately, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you search Loch Ness and don't find anything. People are still going to think that there's something in the lake. You know, it doesn't matter how many times you search for Bigfoot or anything else. There's always going to be the believers who say, well, it just wasn't in there, whatever else. So what I tried to do for my book, recognizing that the mystery was going to continue no matter what I said or wrote, I included an appendix in the book, Appendix 2, in which the title of it is called How to Identify a Chupacabra. And that, to my mind, was my bid to try and keep my book relevant 5, 10, 20, 30 years from now, so that if future investigators, researchers, or anybody that finds some dead animal, if they really believe that they found the chupacabra, I have a list of 10 questions to ask about that. That, you know, if you think you found the chupacabra, you know, go through this list and, you know, check these off and see if in fact, you know, it fits the criterion of what a chupacabra must be in order to exist. Now, if it passes all these tests, that does not conclusively prove it's the chupacabra, but it certainly would go much, much farther in terms of establishing scientific credibility and validity of the creature.
So I know there's sort of a special treat for Mustard Talk listeners. You've given us an audiobook rendition of the first chapter and the intro. So that should be in people's iTunes feed. But where can people actually find your book?
Well, the book is actually it's out. I don't know that it's physically in bookstores yet. It'll probably be in bookstores in the next week or two. You can also go to my website, which is chupacabramystery.com. And I have the book for sale there. I think I include free shipping and I'll autograph it. And I'll even throw in some little cute freebies and photos and little chupacabra related paraphernalia, as they say. So you can get it there. You can get it at Amazon.com. Better yet, you know, go to your local independent bookstores and order it there.
So as you know, as a co-host, we often ask people what their favorite monster is. What's your favorite monster right now?
Well, I hate to do the cop out, but honestly, my favorite monster is the chupacabra.
Lame.
I spent 5 years searching the damn thing. You know, it's just a fascinating mystery.
Okay, why do you think it captured so much of the public imagination? I mean, it was discovered in 1995, or if you want to call it that. And then by the end of 1996, they were filming an X-Files episode about it. So how did it become so popular?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One was that that it was fueled, as I touched on earlier, by tabloid press and sensationalism. You know, every time that an alleged chupacabra was sighted or believed to have attacked some animals, the tabloids were all over it, you know, running big, you know, red headlines, chupacabra attacks, blah, 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 and photos and this and that. So a lot of the information that many people, particularly many Puerto Ricans, were getting about the chupacabra, say in late 1995 and 1996, was very sensationalized and dramatic and exaggerated. And it's a cool creature. It's like this alien-like, blood-sucking beast that, you know, that's supposedly attacking things. And who knows? You know, it might attack people next. So that was part of it. So it really jumped into the public's consciousness after a talk show called Christina, which is essentially the Hispanic, the Spanish language version of Oprah, did a segment on the chupacabra in 1996. I think that was around March or so. And all of a sudden, like, everyone is like talking about the chupacabra. They're seeing the chupacabra. It just exploded after that. And also, the internet, again, in 95, 96, just after Tolentino gave her description and the most popular depiction of it went out there, it's suddenly on the web, and people all over the world are seeing it and reading about this mysterious new monster, creature, vampire thingy in Puerto Rico. And it captured the public's imagination. Bigfoot was old hat. Nessie was even older hat. And hey, who wouldn't be excited by this creature? And so, as you pointed out, within several months of it sort of jumping international borders and being cited in other places, the screenwriters for the X-Files were banging away on the script on that. Making the most out of it.
You sound like you're actually seriously passionate about it. So I assume that was not a cop-out answer about your favorite monster.
No, it's not a cop-out answer. There's just so much to it. I mean, everything from, there's no other cryptozoological creature that I can think of, that is so involved in, conspiracy theory and vampirism and eyewitness problems and testimony in different forms and different shapes. And, there's just so much to it.
I was going to say in the late 90s, when, Coast to Coast AM was really at its peak. Sorry, George Nori. the Chupacabra stories coming in, and the internet was, really taking off as, a place to kind of share these kind of stories of monsters. There were some downright creepy tales of people and having these encounters with the Chupacabra. So mm-hmm. I know what you're talking about. I think all of these hairless dogs have kind of diminished my joy at the mystery side of this creature. But hopefully your book can help me sort of recapture that. At the same time, give me some answers. So I'm looking forward to reading my free comp copy.
it's on the way. It's on the way. No, but I mean, it's, again, in terms of what I solved about it, I mean, I'll just touch on that briefly, which is that, different parts of the Chupacabra story had sort of been touched on or examined by other investigators as well. For example, the vampirism aspect, sort of you get into UFOs and animal mutilations and things like that. But the central mystery to my mind after having researched it for a number of years, the final mystery was, where did it come from? What was its origin? Even though it seemed unlikely that this was an actual living, biological creature, the question still was, okay, well then, what the hell is it? If it's not real, and it may or may not be. I mean, it's anything is theoretically possible. But if most of the evidence for this is very dubious, then what is attacking these creatures, and where did it come from? And
that's the question that you answer in the book.
It is. It's also to be fair, I do all. It is. In fact, to be fair, I do include a section in my Scientific Paranormal Investigations book. I think the last chapter in there is about the Chupacabra, and I also in there talk about my discovery of the Chupacabra's origin. So it's not a huge mystery. It's a little bit of a mystery, but it's out there for people who want to look for it. And again, I hope that people will. Even if they don't believe that I have totally solved the mystery, although I think most people will, even if they don't totally believe it, I hope that they'll recognize that I did the best I could to examine and understand and explain it. And if I'm wrong, or if I've mischaracterized something, or if tomorrow they find a Chupacabra, that's fine. I'll be the first to eat crow and go examine it. But until then, I think this one's case closed.
Well, thanks so much for sharing this with us, and I look forward to reading the book. And wow, what a productive year for you. Yeah.
So. Yeah, yeah, it's and you know, of course, I couldn't have done as much with without Monster Talk. I mean, this has been a great experience, and just dealing with you and Karen and all our fans and listeners, it's very rewarding to have people have such interest in our shared passions and our fascination with these monsters. So it's very cool.
Well, thanks a lot,
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. Today we heard about Ben Radford's latest book, Tracking the Chupacabra. You can find a link to buy his book in our show notes or go to radfordbooks.com. If you check your Monster Talk feed, you should see a free audio sample from his new book preceding this episode. If you like it, please share it with your friends. Monster Talk is produced with the support of Skeptic Magazine. If you like critical thinking and science, you should give it a read. Music for Monster Talk is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. And thanks again for listening to our show.
Hungry for more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Chupacabra, chupacabra, and never came back.